All right. Today is Monday, June 21st, 2021. My name is Noah Schoen. I'm an interviewer on the OHSS Education Narratives Project. I am here today with Carol Murray. I am in Boston, Massachusetts, and Carol is at Bard in New York State, Bard College. It's a remote interview. And just, you know, it's been a couple of months since we've spoken, Carol, and you just told me you have 4 days left of the school year. So let me be the first to say congratulations on finishing your year, being very, very close. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm doing very well. I'm glad that we are we had a successful year from the standpoint of we didn't ever close because of COVID. We've been open since August, and we've been showered with a lot of appreciation and gratitude from the parents. We had a big party last week, and I'm happy we're closing for the summer. I know a lot of people are going to do summer programs, and I'm glad I'm not in that category right now. So I will have about 6 weeks before I need to really gear up for the fall. I'm really looking forward to that.
I also know that you've been in the process of releasing a book that you've written. Illuminating Care. And I wonder if you want to say a little bit about that and what it's been like to start to bring it out in the world. I think it's like shipping any day now.
Yes, it's shipping any day, finally. Yeah, it's been an incredible process. I had a big party with, I guess, about 30 people of my colleagues who were all a part of the sort of professional development group that we have here at Bard that we started about 5 or 6 years ago. They all came for a potluck dinner on June 4th, and we took turns reading the book. It was really great. It was beyond beyond a happy moment, because we were all, you know, eating together, and we were all vaccinated, and we were outside, and it was a lovely night. And I just felt very honored. I felt like the intent of the gathering was really to celebrate the book, but more so for me, just to see people I hadn't seen in a year or more. And it was really a moving experience. The book was, you know, I had friends come that I had taught with 25 years ago. Who are also in the book, you know, who I tell stories about in the book. So it's pretty crazy to think about all those stories that I have been writing down and this message I've been really trying to articulate for 20 years. It's finally, I'm finally finding some shape and some form in the world during COVID. I think it's very timely. It feels really good.
What feels particularly timely about these ideas coming out in this time?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the challenges for me in talking about care as education has been a bit of pushback and actually rejection from the educational field, especially from the early education field. You know, don't talk about, you know, this work in that way, because we've been working so hard to align ourselves with educators, and we don't want to be perceived as something less than education, which is the sort of the opposite message I'm giving, is that by naming care and talking about care as a moral code and an educational philosophy, we can actually examine the very the very moment that we encounter the child, whether it be through feeding the child, dressing the child, the physical maintenance care of the child. That stuff has not been easy to talk about. And I think because of COVID, there has been a heightened awareness around essential workers, around care work, around even sort of the custodial mundane work that often falls upon women. There has been, it has been highlighted that not just the essential nature of the work, but I guess the interconnectedness of us as humans. I think people are more open to the message than they were in the past. So that feels really timely. That feels really timely, that, that there seems to be a better platform to step onto where people can actually hear what we're trying to say when we advocate for care.
As you come to the end of this year, I'm curious if you've been reflecting on that care work differently in the relief of this year, or if it's been more of an affirmation of the things that you've been thinking about.
Yes, I think the year has been an affirmation. I think it's also been a deepening of my own understanding, because I mean, like anything, you know, that we're interested in, for me, being interested in care and reading about care and doing my best to write my own stories down about it. It wasn't until I really was invited into more dialogue about it that I had a better way to talk about it. I've learned so much. And I think also because of the political climate, the heightened racial tension in our nation, there's been some really interesting directions talking about care has taken us. And for me, I always understood sort of the racial sexist policies and histories around labor laws that made care work subordinate to all other work. But I didn't really understand that relationship within the educational systems. So now as I talk to people and people share their specialties, such as the history of childcare and the history of education and the beginnings of professionalizing care work, it's fascinating. I thought I had sort of stumbled upon this like false dichotomy, this thing I was trying to articulate, that not to separate care from education for the young child, and not to put learning in categories, and not to put in academic categories. But one of the things I recently learned about was how very there were these really early nurseries and childcare centers that were originally developed for women who had to work, or women who perhaps had husbands who were disabled or dead because of the Civil War, or drunk, you know, abandoned, depressed. There was just, men were under a lot of stress after the Civil War, during the Civil War. So after that period of time, there was a sort of a robust day nursery program that was for these women who were in these, what society considered these shameful conditions, needing support, needing someone to care for their children. And learning about that history, and then how at the turn of the century, when psychology, you know, and child development sort of became highlighted, and women could actually make a profession out of teaching, all this focus on early childhood development, that there was such an intentional decision back at the turn of the century to say, we are not talking about taking care of children. We are not going to even enter that discussion about children being away from their mothers, you know, the sacred bond between the child and the mom. We who are educating young children are teachers. We are teachers. We are not caregivers. And so there was this very, very intentional, deliberate split that I didn't even know about. So that's something. And just this, as a childcare teacher, I've always grappled with this shame. There's a lot of shame associated with it. Sometimes parents feel guilty for leaving their kids with us. They feel distrustful. They feel, childcare people feel resentful towards parents for sort of, I don't know, treating the industry as sort of an ownership, treating us like they're hired help. There's so many weird feelings that rise up within you when you're caring for other people's children, and to really be able to trace back these historical roots of ownership, of the private-public split, of the distinct separation between education and care. That's just been really, really exciting for me. And those are pretty new revelations for me. I had an inkling and I wrote about it a bit, but I didn't know how deep and how sort of this story that I'm telling is one that's very old. It's really not my story. So it feels very validating.
I love how excited you get when you talk about this. I definitely want to leave room to come back to some of these threads. And I'm also curious about the end of the school year, how it was, how it went, and in particular, how the sort of the rollout of the vaccines implemented the end of the school year, or impacted the end of the school year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had, we really worked hard. I think it was by April, we had all of our teachers vaccinated, and that, you know, that was a whole process in itself, getting the appointments, giving people the day off, and often giving people the day off after the appointment, because a lot of people had reactions. And then getting the second appointment and the same thing, the day off and the day. So again, you know, again, I always feel like in those situations, when I'm in a culture like Bard College, where everyone's saying, oh, I got the shot, or I drove to Albany and I got the shot, I drove to Buffalo, I got the shot, you know, and I just, it sort of highlights again that thing like, well, we're essential. We can't, you know, we can't just take the day off and drive to Albany. Someone has to watch the kids, kind of thing. And then to realize the weight of giving people time off and telling people, go get your shot, you know, take that appointment whenever you can get it, really fell on those of us who were left caring for the children. And so there was kind of a bumpy period in the spring getting everyone through that process, but it was good. And then Bard, I think, lifted the mask mandate, especially for people outside at the end of the semester, which was towards the end of May, but childcare did not lift the mask mandate. So we were still wearing masks inside and outside, and we still are. So there was some confusion with the state regulations and what the governor was saying and how that was affecting the different counties in New York State. And at one time they increased the regulations at the time after people were getting sort of a feeling of a green light that we could relax, especially outside with if we had it vaccinated. There was a couple days where we got a note from Governor Cuomo that said everyone two and over must wear a mask at all times, which childcare pushed back against and said, well, why are things getting more strict for us when everywhere else is becoming more lenient? And, you know, again, it was trying to explain to people that children are in a state of eating and sleeping and resting and playing, and requiring a 2 or 3 or 4 year old to wear a mask when they're in childcare 8 hours a day is not realistic. So we had those conversations all over again that we had had in the fall. And getting to the end of the year, you know, it was really good. We did feel a lot of appreciation and gratitude from our families. And we do feel very, very, I think we feel very much like a tribe, the teachers of us who have been here, doing the work, that we've done something really amazing, that we've been able to care for children and families during a pandemic. We feel very grateful that we weren't on Zoom, that we were in person, that we had kids sitting on our laps, that we had many, many days outside, together with children. It's hard to put it into words. And I think that has been my biggest struggle, is putting it into words, because I have felt such an incredible mixture and layering of just seeing all the different responses from families and teachers. And so I feel a very, very heavy responsibility not to say things that would sound Pollyanna-ish, would sound flippant or uncaring, because it hasn't been easy. It hasn't been easy, but it has also been very rewarding and joyful. And every single person has had a backstory, you know, of a loved one who died, or of a family member who lost their job, or of a friend who is struggling with depression, or, you know, there's been, I think we're still climbing out of a very deep hole. And I think that how we emerge from this will be the next story. And I think it'll be a long story.
Were there any appreciations in particular that made you feel really seen in the work that you've done this year?
I think just the daily interactions from the families. The daily interactions from the families have felt a little bit more intentional. I have felt that the families are appreciative, and also families who have multiple children have compared their experience in our child care center with experiences in the public school or experiences in larger organizations where people didn't have as much flexibility. So I think, you know, being on a liberal arts college and managing a small group of children. And we also had this open air program for the after school for the big kids ages 5 through 10, which was really just dreamy, just really beyond my expectations, the experience the children had there. So I guess I just feel grateful I would hope and wish that children in systems, in educational systems, could have experiences with leaders who have more autonomy. I think that's what I've been really grateful for: more autonomy, more options for creativity and for interpretations, so that you know, really, really amazing things can happen. So many educators have felt they had very limited options and very limited choices. And also I feel that so many educators will return to systems that haven't grown and haven't evolved and haven't changed. In fact, they may be more rigid in the fall, where I feel I'm part of an organization that has really opened and seized every possible opportunity to do what's right for children. And there are families who see that very clearly. And that's exciting.
Is there something that you were able to do this year or accomplish that you're particularly proud of?
I think I'm it's along those same lines. I think I'm feeling, I'm feeling braver about doing less about defending and rationalizing and explaining, but more like just doing bold, beautiful work for children. I don't know if it's my age, I've crossed a threshold where I am maybe not feeling like I need to be making compromises in my life, that I can assert more of what I know is right. So again, the freedom I have at a small program like this, but I think I feel good about a leadership style that is really open to trying something new. And, just being outside as much as possible with children, that kind of thing. I think that there is freedom in sort of finding exceptions, breaking rules, knowing that policies are very loose structures. I think I've always been that kind of educator, but I had that subversive sort of element to understanding my work with kids. But I was always sort of trying to shroud my work in language that made it acceptable. So I feel like I'm kind of done explaining and rationalizing what we do for young children, because it really comes down to play and care. And trust that they're always learning and growing, when they have those things in place.
In thinking about your students, I'm wondering if you could share about the growth this year of a particular student that has been notable to you in some way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think with early childhood, it's always pretty mind-blowing. There's just incredible growth every year for each child. I mean, one year in the life of a 3 or 4 year old is, a third or a fourth of their life. So the growth, physical, milestones, intellectual growth, all that is pretty remarkable. I'm thinking about a couple kids who I saw as maybe having some social anxiety, some social needs, maybe being the kind of kids who I might be worried about going on to kindergarten. So there's one little girl in particular who just doesn't really like to be in groups and always pulls herself apart. And she always builds, you know, castles around herself. She's always enclosed in the block corner or sitting under the table. She's just not a social creature. And I know she's someone who her mom was really worried about. What I saw with her and one other little girl in particular, their parents were so concerned about the isolation and sort of the amount of time they spent at home that this was going to set them back. You know, this was going to set them back because they were not highly social children. I can think of three children that fit into this category, and a little boy and two little girls. They just weren't robust kind of social players. They were, more introverted kind of kids. And what I saw was that having time at home, not having to get up and get dressed and go and be in social situations, because that we closed in March. So they were home March, April, May, June, July to August. Those were the three families that were like, oh my gosh, I don't know how they're going to come back. I don't know. You know, they love being home. They're homebodies. They're introverts. They are not social kids. We really need to work on their social skills. What can we do to get their social skills in place? Those kids did great. I think they gained an incredible sense of belonging. And maybe just like it was good for their nervous system to be home more. They did great. And they re-entered slowly, as we would have expected. They re-entered as observers and with some caution, but they seemed more confident. They seemed more capable of being able to regulate themselves, to pull themselves aside from the group, to find a book or find a teacher's lap to sit on when they needed a break. And then I've just sort of maintained that approach with these kids, you know. I mean, at one point, one of the moms said, you know, maybe I should be setting up one-on-one play dates, or, you know, we go to the birthday parties and he still sits on my lap, blah, 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 blah. And I said, you know, I think knowing your kid doesn't really love to be in a group, doesn't really love to socialize, has a more quiet, observant personality, and honoring that and saturating him with lap time and home time and taking off the pressure that there's something wrong with him because he doesn't jump in the middle of the party is what he needs. He needs the opposite than saturating him with play dates. He needs to be home as much as he needs to be home. So I guess, I mean, that's kind of a long way of saying this feeling that ironically, children become more independent and more confident when we allow them to be more bonded, clingy, needy. When they're bonded and clingy and needy and lacking social skills, it's okay to hold them and let them be kids and let them stay home and let them sit on our laps. You can't push these kind of processes. And it's hard to talk about this idea that our society is really hard on children and families and caregivers, and that we're asking these kids to be in childcare for 40 plus hours a week, and it's probably not good for their nervous system. It's hard to say that because parents get really guilty, you know, and say, this isn't fair. I have to work 8 hour days. What am I supposed to do? But I wish we lived in a society where parents who have children could take time to just the approach to really see who your kid is and And that would mean that you had plenty of sick days and home days where you didn't feel the pressure that you had to get to work. And that would mean if you wanted your child only to be in childcare part-time, there would be some sort of subsidy for you to get some sort of partial work pay or something so that you could, you or your spouse wouldn't have to work 40 hours a week. Or maybe that time could be spent if you wanted to put your kid in full-time childcare, maybe you could get paid leave to volunteer at the school for, you know, 3 or 4 hours a week. So you could be more collaborative and in a sort of a cooperative care model. I just worry about this expectation, these social expectations on children that are so young. And I don't think 40 hours a week, 50 hours a week of childcare is good for all children. Some kids can adapt beautifully, and even kids who have a hard time can adapt too. And we take that very seriously to create these habitats that are suited for children, that are places where children can thrive and grow, no matter what their personality is. But I wish we could strengthen the family bond more intentionally. I'm all for universal child care. And I think universal child care means families need to have lots of options. And sometimes the options should be, you know, limiting the number of hours a kid has to be away from their parents between the ages of 0 to 5. For some kids, it's different for all children. But I've just seen that those kids who are lacking social skills, who we think need more socialization, need more play dates, need to learn how to share, what they really need is just more security, more time to be themselves and to feel like they belong. I do think there's an incredible link between the nervous system of some children, just the kids who have those sort of anxiety, careful kind of nervous systems, and putting them in group settings is a lot to ask. It's a big ask of a young person. I've never really been able to talk about it because, I mean, I've been certain kids where I've wanted to say to the mom, could you just pick them up on Wednesday afternoon? You know, just maybe one day a week. Could you just pick them up at 1 o'clock instead of 5:15? Because I think just one afternoon where you come pick them up and you have lunch together and you take a nap together or go for a walk, I think that could just help him regulate. I do see kids at the end of a 40, 50 hour week who it just feels stressful. I also know people who have shortened their hours, childcare directors who have said, this is too much. This is, you know, we're living in this completely ridiculous world with no resources for the caregivers, and the pay for, you know, the private childcare centers is just not adequate. So they've reduced their hours. So they've said, you know, next year I'm not staying open until 5 or 6. I'm going to close every day at 3:30. I'm going to take care of my teachers, and I'm going to try to work with families to help them understand that kids have a hard time being away from home for 8+ hours a day. And I can't do that. I just feel like that would be an abandoning of families. I feel like it is hard to be a parent. It's hard to be a parent working in this economy and this culture. And I want to be there for families if they need me to be there till 5:30 because they have to work. I want to be there for them. But it's just this strange push and pull of what it means to have kids in childcare, spending so much time in our care. And when we try to talk to parents about strengthening the family bond, it feels like it causes parents to feel incredibly stressed and guilty. So I'm not sure how to have those conversations.
outside of work. Oh, were you just going to say, did you have another thought there?
It really does come down to finances and policy. I'm just thinking about my own situation. I was a childcare director and I didn't want to put my own kids in 40 hours a week. So my husband stayed with them 2 days a week. So we had like two daddy days and my kids had 3 days of childcare and two and, you know, 5 days at home. If you put the 7 days together, 4 days at home and 3 days of childcare. But we put everything on the credit card too. You know, it's just, it does come down to finances. It's just, the childcare business model is just a mess for families. You were saying about my personal life or?
Yeah, no, I'm also just reflecting on what you said, that you have to live within the constraints of the system that's not really set up to care, and mm-hmm. it makes it difficult to navigate.
Mm-hmm.
I think the question I was going to ask is in some ways connected to that, which is, you know, as a caregiver, you know, since our last interview in these last few months, how has life been for you outside of work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm lucky that I have a partner. My husband is a good shares in all the care responsibilities of the home and the children. It's been stressful. Yeah, it's been stressful. I've been caring, you know, my father died. I've been really caring for my mother, although she's very independent, caring for her as much as I can emotionally as she's grieving my father's death and having her here, staying with us, living with us off and on this year, watching my teenager struggle with online school and isolation. It has been a hard year. And I think caring for the teachers who are all struggling with the same issues with kids at home and elderly parents. It's really a universal situation. We all are in some sort of care relationship, and those relationships have been more important than ever. So I think we've all, I think so in some ways the way I've cared for my son has been different. I think it's helped me because of the struggles he's had with school. I've really shifted. I mean, I've just really shifted my focus on sort of what I want for him in terms of just staying connected to him. And I've let a lot go. I've let a lot go in terms of, you know, worried about grades or homework or standards or keeping up, and just really focused on staying connected, making sure he's feeling connected and belongs, knows he belongs. I think maybe all the online time also helped us rethink all the structures that we have always assumed were, I don't know, they are so artificial, but we didn't always see how artificial they were. You know, we always assumed that those things needed to be in place for us to function, and, you know, they don't need to be in place. You know, you don't have to have an office to work. You don't have to have a classroom to go to school. You don't have to, you know, there should be more flexibility in everyone's life. And again, I would like to extend that to families. Like, why not when your child's sick, you know, why, if your child's sick, why can't you work from home and care for your child at the same time? If you can get in 4 to 6 hours with your computer and your Zoom meetings, or, you know, there's just so many ways to get things done now we can use technology to our advantage, and technology can help us be better caregivers. There's really no reason high school kids have to go walk into that building 6-7 hours a day and sit in those classrooms at those desks. So many of our structures are very artificial and built around sort of the factory work model. So I hope that COVID has helped us in that way. I have a feeling education is going to be the last thing standing, clinging to some old ways.
Why?
I don't know. I think what is inherent in the structure of our educational systems is ranking, hierarchy. Those things are hard to break away from. So grades, standards, marks of achievement, marks of failure, marks of success. There's just always this focus. How are we going to measure it? How are we going to put that, you know, stamp of approval on and keep track of everyone? So that's why I think it's probably going to be the last thing to crumble, because those values and those ideals are so entrenched. Competition and ranking.
I'm thinking about what you just said about your shift in caring from your son, and in the way that you care for the son, and in the ways that it reflects your belief that, you know, that care and play and nurturance is more important than these measures. And I'm even thinking back to a story you shared in our first interview about a teacher who told you as a young girl, you know, you're going to be okay. You're going to be all right.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I'm wondering is, how do we trust that what do we need to do or feel or move through so that we can start trusting that these acts of care are enough for our young people?
Yeah. Well, I think there, you know, that's a big question. I do think there's a shift. I mean, trust goes hand in hand, I think, with, or at least trust steps away from fear, right? So much of what we do is fear-based. You know, we're afraid. And you could tie that fear back to love and care. We're afraid our children will get hurt, so we don't let them climb a tree. We're fearful that our children won't be successes in life, so we want to make sure they reach these standards and that they learn this and that if someone tells them they need to learn that. So I don't know, but I think it's a gigantic sort of spiritual, esoteric kind of moral shift. And that is a lot to ask. In sort of asking, what is the purpose of life? What is the meaning of life? What's interesting is when you examine sort of the standards, the benchmarks, you know, that we've defined as first grade, second grade, third grade, high school, college, all those things. They're really quite, lowest common denominator kind of standards. They're not really that rigorous. So I think that recognizing sort of human potential is, you know, the interrelatedness of critical thinking, creative thinking, and care and belonging and trust, like, you know, those, the standards we can reach are much greater. Our potential is much greater than these artificial structures. But I think that really comes to the individual sort of individual knowing that, the parent knowing that. I think as we give people more and more permission, you know, sometimes you find that it's a relief, it's a validation, you know, that the diploma or the benchmark or the, you know, the good job or whatever it is we associate with success does not make the person. So I guess it does all come back to that valuing of the person. And then it comes back to that relationship of care and that is hopefully going to propel the person to be themselves, to be what they want, to follow their path instead of following, you know, something artificial. I don't know. I'm kind of talking in circles, but I don't know. I don't know what it's going to take to help us make. I think we're in the middle of it. I think we're in the middle of a big shift, hopefully. And it's going to take a long time. I know it's baby steps. Yeah, I don't think I've made much sense just now. I hope you don't use that clip.
As you're looking forward to the fall, I'm curious about what's on your mind.
I think what's on my mind is I do think there's some restructuring on my mind. So I think what's on my mind is how can I think the next like sort of career goal for me is to just really figure out this whole partnership with parent piece, because I think a lot of my view of myself in the industry has been like the client service oriented, you know, and I think I'm ready to be more like a partner and have more. A very concrete example would be instead of having curriculum night where we get all the parents together and we talk about how children learn through play and what math and science looks like in the sandbox and all that kind of stuff, that I would just have like regular coffee with parents, a lot of talking in the mornings at drop off, more connection, more individualized kind of counseling and support for families around the questions that they have, instead of trying to be like this market early childhood education and explain and rationalize what we do. A little bit more empathy for how hard it is to be a parent. I think maybe I can take a long view and think back over my children's lives and think about the teachers who made difference to me as a parent and think about the kind of things that they said to me or the kind of relationship I had with those people. And then there's also the non-examples of the people who, you know, who just were not helpful to me at all as a parent and did not connect with my kids or understand that we had very different goals than they held for us. So Yeah, I think to me it's about this shift and it's still a service. It's still a service, but I don't know. The relationship with the families is a priority to me coming out of this.
I'm just wondering if there's anything else that you want to touch on from these last few months that's been significant to you in some way.
I think that, you know, I think I've got a lot of validation in my talks about the book and sort of the stories I've told in the book and this it's but my validation has come from Zoom meetings, people in Kansas and Seattle, and podcasts, people in, you know, other parts of the country. So I have this weird kind of like, I think the reason my message is often very relevant and powerful is because I have been in the work. I mean, a lot of people who are writing about care or stepping into those roles of teaching others, teaching adults are really are quite removed from the work, and I'm really in it, which might be why it took me so long to write the book and to get the message out. You know, really, really in it, really emerging from this life of raising two boys and being a childcare director and an early childhood teacher and having daily contact with kids and families. So there's this weird thing where I'm talking about my work to people and it's really resonating, and I'm feeling more confident in the way I explain my book. But yet at home, I feel with my own school, I feel the message is harder to deliver. I guess maybe it's that split between what you preach and what you practice, or like what there's some sort of phrase. I don't know what it is. Something about the prophet in his own field. You know, the people that are closest to you can't really hear you or see you as an expert, but people, if you know, people far away might value you more. Yeah, I felt like I've been fumbling a lot with my leadership and my relationship with the teachers here. And that causes you when you're it causes me to feel like, oh, you know, it's easier said than done, to create these cultures of caring and to be an exemplary model of leadership, or to be a teacher of adults, and easier said than done. It's really hard to uphold that sort of ethic in the day to day. The day to day is hard, and so I guess that's good. I guess that's really good because it just I keep turning it in on myself and practicing it, and I've gotten better at being kinder to myself about that, you know, that knowing that this has been sort of what I'm fascinated with and what I'm studying, and that's, you know, probably reveals it's something that I really need to learn myself. So I guess the ultimate test of all that is how you treat yourself on that learning process. I think when you're a leader in your own place, in a small place like this, it's sort of intimate, caring for children. I don't know, people just have a hard time sort of understanding. I feel like for me, people have always been like, why is Carol so particular about this one thing? Why is she so passionate about that? And their interpretation becomes that because I'm the boss, or because I'm in charge, or because I want to impress or something. And then it always catches me off guard when my truest instinct is, I don't have a choice. This is the way I'm driven to live my life. I have a passion, you know, and it's really important to me that we practice in a way that is aligned with what we know is best. And so I carry a high standard. And I think that is confusing to people who work for me, because they think, oh, Carol's sweet and she talks about care and she'll understand. And I do understand and I do care for people, but I still, I don't know, maybe I drive people too hard. Maybe I drive myself too hard, you know, but it does come from that place of wanting to get it right. And it's not that you can follow an instruction manual. It's not that kind of get it right. But when it comes to the way we encounter children and families and each other, I'd like it to be the highest quality that we can offer. So ironically, my drive to create a person-centered environment can cause stress on the people who are trying to deliver this. So it's very embedded. How do we do this in a way that allows us to take care of ourselves and take and have that sort of forgiveness and attention to care in all our interactions? I don't know if that makes sense.
Does to me. Before we close this interview, and I want to ask you one last question. I do want to make sure that we have an introduction for you on the record. So I'm wondering if you could just state your full name and describe who you are and what you do to someone who might not have a picture of you or be able to see you or know anything else about you.
My name is Carol Garboden Murray, and I am an early childhood educator. I am a director of a childcare program, and I have spent about 30 years teaching and caring for children ages 0 to 5. Early childhood is my specialty. And I recently wrote a book called Illuminating Care, the Pedagogy and Practice of Care in Early Childhood Communities. So my book, Illuminating Care, is just now coming into print this year, 2021, right as we emerge, hopefully, from the pandemic, from the world COVID-19 pandemic.
Thank you for that. And as we close this interview, I want to invite you to leave a message for yourself, to a future version of you that may be listening to this interview and reflecting on all the interviews that we've done this year. What's a message that you'd like to leave for yourself?
I guess I would like to say that I don't know, a message for myself. I keep going back and forth. Maybe advice for myself would be to slow down. Maybe slow down. It seems like when you slow down and allow time for pondering, that some of the things that you're grasping for and rushing for are already there. They come to you quite naturally and easily. So slow down and allow and slow down instead of rushing and grasping. I think that's what I'd say.
Well, thank you very much, Carol, as always. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
You too. Thank you so much.